All right, where's all my teachers this morning? You ready to go in the morning? Just deep, dark sadness. This, you know, your poor husbands, too. They're going to have to deal with you for the next few days because all of life is darkness, doom and gloom. Where's all my students? How many of you guys know that your teachers are going to be the ones who bring great oppression and hardness into your life? And in the next 2 days, the freedom that you've enjoyed for the last 3 months or so is over. Man, I'm really opening with the stinker, aren't I? How many parents here are like, yes, they're going back to school and they're out of my house. Praise Jesus, the oppression is over. Anyway, first of all, I do that because it kind of helps me with where I'm going just to kind of start with a laugh and a chuckle. But I also do that because I just want our teachers to know. We kind of have become a church that has a high population of teachers and a high population of nurses. I just want to, what two great professions. And for those of you who are teachers, obviously I've spent my life around a lot of teachers. My mom and dad both teach. My mom is an elementary teacher, has been doing it for forever. My dad taught elementary and then high school and coached in public school in one of the hardest public schools in St. Louis areas. And God used them, and it was a real calling for both of them. And then I married a great lady who became a teacher, it's a real sense of calling. And I know that teaching is more than just a job. It's a calling. It is a real sense of you want to be used by God, especially if you're a follower of Jesus and you're a teacher. The reason you do is because you want to be used by God to make a difference in the lives of people, especially kids. And so I applaud those of you who are in that profession. Nursing the same way. You want to serve people. Over the last few weeks and months, we've been around a lot of ladies and men who came into rooms in the hardest of situations and brought hope and light. And so we kind of become a church with a high population of those two professions. And with this being the week of going back to school, I know that you feel oppressed, and that's what we're talking about this morning. We're talking about when life is hard, and especially looking at oppression and those sorts of things. And I know that you already know from looking at your roster of your class, the three kids that are going to bring great oppression this school year. My challenge for you is to pray for those kids because you never know what God might do through your life and the lives of those kids and what God might do in the lives of those kids through you, like put you in a home. But anyway, we're talking about the book of Ecclesiastes. If you have a Bible, you can flip over to Ecclesiastes. If you don't have a Bible, we'd love for you to take one. We'll be on page 471. There's Bibles at the end of your rows. If you don't have a Bible that's yours, if you're a guest with us, we would love for you to take one of those. Or even if you're not a guest, we'd love for you to take those Bibles. I actually got a box in this week, and one of the I get excited when the UPS guy shows up with a box of Bibles because we had to order more, okay? We love giving away Bibles. And so there's Bibles there for you to take, give them to friends, whatever. But in that Bible, if you use that, we're going to be on page 471. And this book, if you've been with us for a few weeks, is a hard book. I mean, this is not your glossed over four steps out of all the hardship of life spirituality. And just being around the church world all my life, I get really leery of people who have simple solutions to deep and very complex problems. Even as we deal with Ecclesiastes, I have this tendency when I study and I prepare sermons to create it in bite-sized chunks, and you end up with an outline that's on the back of your worship folder. Because that's just, I'm a very logical, linear thinker. It keeps me on task. It helps me to have an outline. And for some people, it helps you to see it. But the danger is that you see that and you think that I'm just giving you three easy steps or three real, and I never intend to do that. Because there are things in life that you go to some seminar and some preacher stands on a stage and said, let me give you four steps out of depression. And you go do those four steps and you get to the end of that and you've done the four steps the guy told you to do and you're more in the dumps, you are more depressed, you are more freaked out, and now you have tried something somebody on stage told you, if you'll just do these four things, it'll all be better, and it's not, and it makes it worse. And sadly, the Bible often does not give us these nice, neat, packaged, easy solutions to complex problems. What the Bible does for us is tells us to pursue Jesus in those issues. But that's not even simple. It's a complex relationship with a God who has created all and who is sovereign over these issues, but sometimes is sovereign over them, but his sovereignty works outside our realm of understanding. And we live in a world that is having a hard time. I mean, if you went out and just like walked the streets and asked people, what's your biggest beef about God? The answer would be, I look around and see that it's a really jacked up world with really jacked up people. And to be honest with you, I have a really hard time resolving that with a good and loving, benevolent God. So the number one question is people try to deal with, is there really a God? The biggest question you're going to have, I'm not really going to try to answer that question this morning. There's some great books, great resources. I'll send you to one that I think a guy recently wrote that really deals with some of these great questions in a great way. And if you want to write this down, and go, if you struggle with why does all this happen, how do I know who God is, how do I make sense, a guy named Tim Keller wrote a book called The Reason for God, and he answers these questions, does a great job. But just be forewarned, he doesn't give nice, neat, little packaged arguments that just fit together real time. He'd realize that these are complex issues. Oppression in the world is a complex issue. The fact that even this morning, as the world is kind of coming together and singing Kumbaya together, and we have the Olympic rings, and now we're all one world, or, you know, diverse, but one world around the Olympic rings, in a country that there is massive amounts of protests going on because of the oppression that takes place in that country. We look around, even like pick up the newspaper and read, and you begin to realize there are incredible stories. And what tends to happen for me as I read the newspaper, I read the story, but my heart never sinks into the story, right? I mean, you read, well, somebody got murdered in the streets of St. Louis last night, and that's just, oh, that's too bad. St. Louis isn't safe. And my mind does not drift into the fact that there is a family who is dealing with unbelievable brokenness this morning. And a person who may have gone into eternity without Jesus. And so I don't read the newspaper that way. I keep it at those issues at a distance. As I was talking to a lady who was cutting my hair about the deal where the Maplewood firefighter got killed a couple weeks ago, we were talking about, you know, just that story. And everybody gets wrapped up into the depth of pain for the person who lost the loved one. But I can tell you from personal experience that the family of the man who committed the murder, they'll never be the same. Because Heidi and I, when we were in Central Missouri, actually were in a situation where a guy whose parents were members of the church we were in shot and killed 4 police officers and then was arrested and put on death row. This elderly couple, I mean, I can't tell you the depth of hurt and pain. They never left their house again in this little community. And what I'm saying is you probably saw the stories back in the early 90s about this event. It's the biggest manhunt in the state of Missouri. It took place in our backyard. Nobody knew the story of Ward and Mary Johnson. What happens is we live in a world where stories about these, for us, they're just newspaper stories or something we want to see on TV, but in the midst of it, there are these deep anguish and pain where people are hurting and struggling with just how jacked up this world is and how messed up people are and how depraved and broken things are. And preachers who stand up and just try to give you nice, easy solutions to get undepressed and get out of it are doing a disservice to God, to you, and to the scriptures. Now, what I hope to do this morning is walk through Solomon. This is what, I mean, you know, those of you who are like, you're 3 weeks into church, you're like, oh my gosh, this is the most depressing place I've ever been for church. every week the message really stinks, and I leave here wanting to cry and go put black fingernail polish on. That's my life. Because, well, what's going to happen next week is we're going to get happy. We're going to get better, okay? In fact, we've titled this series of messages The Days of Our Lives, you know, sands through the hourglass, all that. What we've done is taken Ecclesiastes, we're preaching straight through the book. As we preach through the book, though, we've kind of broken it up. And so we did a series called The Pursuit of Happiness, where we looked at this guy whose name was Solomon. He was the king over Jerusalem. And basically what he did is he tried everything to fill the hole in his heart. He tried pleasure, he tried sex, he tried wisdom, he tried learning, he did it all, tried money, tried power. And his conclusion is, everything I tried left me empty and wanting more and realizing there had to be something else under the sun, because everything that I pursued, I ended up realizing it was just vanity. It was chasing after the wind. It was a vapor. It was a puff of smoke. It was like breathing into the cold air and the air's, your breath is gone. And his conclusion as he pursued happiness was that this is life. Life is vanity. It is just vapor. That theme continues all the way. We'll see it twice in the text we're going to read this morning as he says, man, life is just, it's gone and there's no meaning into it. And what Solomon is doing is he is giving this book where he examines these deep, hard questions as somebody who has been a searcher, but somebody who really, apart from God in his life, has not found any real answers. And this is what he's saying. This is the whole deal. All of Ecclesiastes, this is what he's going for. He's saying, listen, if life under the sun is all that there is, if that's it, if life under the sun, I mean all the toil and activity under the sun, if that is all that there is, there is no meaning, there is no value, there is no human value, there is no purpose, there is really no reason to go on living. I have tried it all, I have done it all, I have thought through it all, and I got to tell you, if this is all there is, this is the most pointless thing in the world. And what he says is, he says, I dare you to prove me wrong. I dare you to prove me wrong. In the study of philosophy, actually, Solomon predates every major philosopher. The study of philosophy has been the exercise in proving Solomon's point. If this is all there is, no matter which way philosophy takes, as people have tried to think, what's the meaning of life? How do I make sense of all this? Why do bad things happen? And if they just try to make it fit under the sun, Every philosopher, every philosophical approach ultimately just proves Solomon right. And so the second series we've kind of been in is called The Days of Our Lives, is we're looking at life. And really what Solomon has told us up to this point in the last few chapters is life is really hard. And one of the main reasons life is really, really difficult and really, really tough is because there is this massive bookend, the bookend of death. We've dealt with that for the last couple of weeks, and the song we heard was from a text where he talked about living in time and eternity, you know, to everything there's a season. But now he's going to say there's another real issue that as I look around, I see this bookend of death, but I also look around at life, and there are some major questions. And there are questions that we have, that our culture has, that our society has, that they struggle with. And that's the question of, you know, people are deeply hurting. But a large percentage of the hurting in people's lives is because people are just self-centered, wicked. I mean, a lot of the stuff going on in the world is just because people do it to each other. That there is a disconnect in human relationships that just really has messed everything up. And Solomon kind of expresses with us. I mean, we need to feel this with Solomon this morning. I can't make sense of that. I don't understand where the oppression comes from. Now, if you're like me, you know, your oppression started with your little sister. You know, she terrorized you and made your life a living nightmare, and you thought that was bad. But the reality is we look around, and the stories we see are just like, seriously, how can that group of people be like that to that group of people? How can that individual? When you sit with somebody and their story is, I really don't know that God can forgive me, because I can't forgive my uncle who raped me when I was 15. What do you do with that? Other than have this deep desire to go take care of that uncle. I have a friend who called me. The dude all he could do was cry. All he could do. His story, I'll try to keep it brief and short, but his story is that he's just a guy who struggles in a lot of life, not with moral stuff, just he struggles because he does not have the resources, both socially and mentally, to really have a job and do things that where he can make a lot of money and be okay in life. And so basically, as a guy who's as old as I am, a little older than I am, he has been a bagger at Schnucks all his life, makes just above minimum wage, has lived with his mom, has never met a girl, wants so desperately for somebody to love him. And his whole life has been that at least his mom is around. He lived with both his parents when his dad died. It was really hard. He got really afraid that he would lose his mom. And about 3 weeks ago, his mom was in a really tragic car accident, broke both of her legs horribly, has been in a home. And this guy is so freaking alone that all I can do is cry. I mean, I sit and talk to him, and I can't understand anything he says because it's just this. And what's going on, it's not just that his mom is in this home, it's that he makes just barely enough to take care of their needs. But his family, he's got brothers and sisters who actually have good jobs and good families, don't want the financial problems of their mom falling on him, and they are really massively oppressing my pal. This guy who's gotten nothing, had a little bit of savings, been making nothing all his life, has $12,000 in student loans. The best years of his life were in college because he had a group of people that hung out with him, but he also acquired these massive student loans that he can't pay off because the college degree isn't helping him get a job. And as he's struggling with all this, there's oppression even in his family as they want to wash their hands of any of the financial responsibilities of this woman who has to be in a nursing home. And he is stuck. And I want to tell you, as I was even wrestling with this text and dealing with what does Solomon talk about, God dropped another real life example. There are no nice, easy, packaged little answers for my pal. Now, does that mean we just throw our hands up and give up? No, and we'll get to there. That my goal is to get to maybe how the scriptures, what they point us to. But I want you to feel the tension. Not a lot of humor right now, okay? Feel the tension of things that we all know are real and there and hard in life. And I want you to see that the Bible does not run from those things. And neither does Solomon. As God revealed through Solomon this book of philosophy, he doesn't run from these things. So we're going to be looking at some issues here. Chapter 4, beginning with verse 1, is what he says. He says, again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. Behold, the tears of the oppressed, that they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. Now, basically what's going to happen in this passage is that Solomon is going to kind of deal with three kind of interrelated, intertwined issues, struggles, major social issues that he, even as king, is looking around, and they trouble him deeply. They're the great why questions, the great things that we, if we stop and try to grasp, if we could sit down and have 5 minutes with God and give him a list of 3 or 4 questions, we would say, God, why does this stuff happen? We would all ask those questions. We would all struggle with Solomon on making sense because we all have people in our lives that are like my friend. We all read the newspaper and have those moments where in the reading of the newspaper, all of a sudden something, a page jumps off and it goes deep in our heart and we start to resonate with the person who's hurting. We all see the stories and hear, there's something in our lives that has pulled us into the struggle that Solomon has. And so we're going to look at, there's three kind of real and interrelated issues here that are these social issues that are part of these big why questions. And the first issue is the issue of oppression. He says, I saw the oppressions that are done under the sun. And basically the word oppression is the idea of cheating and defrauding another purpose for the sole purpose of unjust gain. It's the idea, I mean, just one human being using another person for something they want without a whole lot of care about what that is. And we look around in our world, we see this everywhere. We see the hurting, we see the struggle. One of the things I've always liked to do is I've always enjoyed going to like civil rights museums. And I've probably talked about this in here before, that as I go on trips, if we head south to Memphis, to Birmingham, to different places like that, where there is some kind of museum to the struggle for civil rights, I like to go in those places. I like to take my children. I've loved taking teenagers and other people through there. And one of the things that as I walk through these places where there's tributes to Martin Luther King and to the different struggles that went on as part of the movement in the 60s and into the 70s, and really way back before that and still going on today, one of the things that I always end up walking out of there deeply broken with is the fact that it really was, in many ways, the white Christian church in the South that kept those conditions. Now, I'm not saying all white Christians, I'm not saying all white churches, okay? But I'm just being honest, the white Christian church in the South that kept that situation the way it was for as long as it went. As those who would meet in churches with big white steeples on Sunday morning would come up with theologies that justified their right to put another people down. And what really is I struggle with that is I don't get mad at those. Well, I do. I get mad at those people. But I begin to realize that what would have happened if I'd have been in one of those churches at that time? Would I have been the one who broke the mold, or would I have just settled in and been comfortable with the oppression that was going on with who I am? And so those issues, now please don't hear me, I'm not trying to oversimplify that whole issue. I'm just telling you, as I go through and I see the struggle of that movement, I realize that my people really were part of the problem. And what happens for me is I realize all the time as I look around, I see that this is the reality all the time. As I point to them really needs to be pointing back to me. As I say, you know, I see the oppression, I see the hardness and the brokenness in the world that comes from people who mistreat others. But I find myself often going into restaurants feeling like I can just treat the waitress any way I want to because she is there to serve me and make me happy. And sometimes it's just a matter of degree. And what he says, I see the oppression that's going on around. I see the problem. I see the tears of the oppressed. I see that these people are broken. And I also see that power is on the side of the oppressor. Whether it's government power, financial power, racial power, social power, that people, we have this incredible tendency to take the power that we have and use it to get our way, even if in the midst of all that power, the use of that power, it puts other people in places where it kind of puts them down and keeps them in their place. And now Solomon's not trying to give us nice, neat, easy, tidy solutions. He is just making an observation that this is just the way the human heart basically works. We can't argue with what he says. It's true. I look around. I see oppressed people. I see that they are oppressed often because people who have more power will do anything to keep their power and wealth and put other people down and keep them in their situation. And a lot of other people will stand around and do nothing. And that situation just creates a very difficult thing for us to work through because there is massive amounts of suffering in our world that doesn't come because of earthquakes or things like that. It comes because one group of people holds on to power and uses that power to put another group of people down. And you go to some of the countries like, you know, in Africa and Central Africa where there is more than enough food available to feed the people, but the people in power there use that as a way to keep their power. But part of the struggle we have to have this morning living in Eureka, Missouri, is that very subtly we make sure we protect our wealth too, without really stopping often and thinking, protecting our wealth And you do realize that if you drive a car, if you drove a car here this morning, you're richer than like 95% of the people in the world. In protecting our wealth, we literally are sometimes just passively involved in some of the struggle. Now, this isn't a feel guilty because you drive a car and have a house. Solomon's observation is this is the way the world is. It stinks. I don't know what to do with it. And he is the king. I mean, if anybody has financial resources, he does. But he also is looking at himself going, I got to be real honest. I'm, as a king who has a massive house with gold everywhere, let's be real honest, I'm a big part of the problem. And so his response to this, look at this. This is, you know, like I said, paint your fingernails black, get a trench coat, dye your hair black kind of stuff. He says, I thought that the dead who already were dead were more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not yet seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. He says, listen, it's better to be dead than alive, and better than both of them is the fictional one who never existed. Now, I will say, and this isn't, you know, this is just kind of, it just popped here, okay? So I'm stepping on a limb, but this is actually kind of sometimes the argument for abortion. I mean, to kind of pull it from Solomon here. Now, my response to that is I do think there is a purpose to life that is found in Christ. And that Christ can give meaning to these things, although it not necessarily simple answers. But do you hear the struggle, man? It'd be better for a kid not to come into this world than for him to come in and live in the ghetto where he sees right up in right in your face all these issues. And that's kind of Solomon's struggle. He's like, man, people who are dead, people who haven't lived, they're really the better off ones because the people who are here have to live with seeing this and dealing with the oppression that goes on in our world. Tough issue. The second thing is he talks about envy, verses 4-6. Then I saw the toil and the skill and work come from a man's envy and his envy of his neighbor. This is also vanity and striving after the wind. This is what he says. He says, listen, everything that I look around, I'm checking humanity out, I'm seeing myself, I'm being real honest. Anybody who tries to get good at anything where they can do it well, the reason they do it is because they see somebody else and they want to be like them and they want to be liked, they want to be cool, they want to fit in. This is why instead of going up to Walmart and buying a $5 or $10 pair of Wrangler jeans, we go to JCPenney and we buy a $110 pair of Wrangler jeans. It is not because you don't buy Wrangler jeans. No teenager in their right mind would wear Wrangler jeans. I get that. Well, I'm sorry. In Eureka, about half of them do, but that's a totally different issue. Eureka is this weird anomaly where these two cultures collide and they get along. It's weird. This total redneck, wear a cowboy boot. It's the only town. I'm not making this up, okay? I am not making this up. I worked with the Eureka the baseball league this summer, like running tournaments, ESA, where they do baseball down here. And I worked with the umpires a lot. And these umpires, I kept getting in trouble because these guys, all the umpires in Eureka, they are great guys, but they all live out, you know, on the other side of the river. And I kept having to tell them, dude, you cannot have the can of Skull in your back pocket and the knife on your hip and umpire a game. It scares these 8-year-olds for you to have your Leatherman hanging out there, okay? I am not making this up. I drove up to a baseball game, and a guy was umpiring in a pair of cowboy boots and a cowboy hat. I was like, dude, really? I mean, the cowboy boots, I'm not going to fire you or like get on you for that because we'd have to throw every umpire out. That we wouldn't have anybody left. But get a baseball hat on. Look like a baseball guy, please, okay? That was the Wrangler jeans thing. By the way, I'm wearing Wranglers this morning, so... My wife knew. Anyway, why do we buy a $110 pair of jeans? Why do we go to Hollister and buy a shirt that cost them $2.50 to make and pay $28 for it? Why do we go to Starbucks? Because there's something about holding onto that cup that makes me feel like, hey, I'm cool, I'm valued. Really, I mean, and I'm with you, okay? I Starbucks, I love it. I like the coffee. But somebody I like to be standing around holding the coffee cup to show everybody that I am cool. Right? There is a sense in which I will pay $3.50 too much. Now, I hang out with my friend Brian. He just makes fun of me. But I won't drink his coffee either, because his coffee, if you like pour it on paint, just will eat through the paint, through the metal. He drinks this black stuff that is like thick, and I can't drink that either. But he makes fun of me because I do this. Why do we do that? And what Solomon is saying, let's be real God honest with ourselves. Let's be real honest. I work overtime. I do all this other stuff. I get really good at my job. I work very hard at what I do. But down deep, there is this thing where there is something inside me that I do that stuff because I see what the people around me have and I want to be as good, accepted, or better. However that fleshes out, it could flesh out in so many different ways. And so guys go to the gym for hours upon end, not because they really like the gym, but they really like what happens is they pull their shirt off on the beach and girls go. On the other hand, not going there. And girls, Solomon's observation. Is he right? Yeah, he is right. We get good at the things we do because we want somebody else to honor us, observe it, to feel, we want to be as good as everybody or better so that we're recognized. Envy for your neighbor. And what he says is, I'm just taking a real good, honest look at the human heart. Let's be honest. Yeah, that's why we do the things we do. That's why we buy the clothes we buy or drive the car we drive. Something inside of us just wants that. Now, once again, this is not, go sell your car or get rid of all the Hollister shirts or, you know, whatever it is. I'm not saying, what Solomon is doing is he's taking a real good evaluation. He's saying, as I look into humanity, ultimately, and this is tied to the oppression. Don't disconnect it. I look into the humanity, I see that our hearts are kind of wired this way, but it's created a mess of the world, and I don't know how to make sense of it. And so what he does, he gives us these two proverbs. Solomon wrote most of the book of Proverbs. A proverb is a short, pithy saying, you know, something Bill O'Reilly would like, right? A short, pithy saying that just, you read it, and you're like, I get it. Yeah, that's a simple statement that has a lot of truth in it. You know, and makes a lot of sense. And so he gives us two. He says, the first one, he says, the fool folds his hand and eats his own flesh. That's a lovely thought. But it's a little proverb, short, pithy saying that helps us see. He's going to tell us two ways people respond to this envy issue. He says, the fool just goes and sits and plays video games for 22 hours a day. Won't get a job, won't work, just sits around and just kind of becomes a leech and sucks everything out of life from himself and everybody around him, and basically he cannibalizes himself. One response to the envy is just to be so countercultural, but you just ditch it all, and there's no productive part of your life in society. You just, you know, that's your life. He says that's one response, and there's fools around. There's people who, you know, they go to college and they get their degree, but then after they get their degree, they live in their grandma's basement and play Halo all day long. Can I get a witness? Anyway, and they just can't get. What's really kind of weird about this is working with teenagers all these years, there's this weird culture of people that I've hung out with that I see this in their lives. And what happens? They hit about 28 or 29 years old, and they go, wow, my life is not working. I don't know what to make of this. Now, please don't mishear me. If you're here, you're like, I live with my parents, and I'm not like dogging that. My point is, I'm trying to show you what Solomon's trying to say. Using situations to better yourself is good. Using situations just to become a leech in life is not. There's all kinds of ways we can just fold our hands. You see, just fold our hands and go, I just throw up my hands, I don't care. I'm just going to fold my hands, sit here, and drink sweet tea the rest of my life. He says, that person just kind of becomes a cannibal. He just kind of consumes himself. But the flip side is this. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and striving after the wind. The flip side, some people, their response is, I'm just going to fold my hands and do nothing. The other side of this is that we just get sucked into the rat race and we are chasing our tail, running in circles, striving after the wind, trying to make something of our lives and make it work, but we're always chasing this envy and there's always somebody who has more and our lives get consumed with that. And as our lives get consumed with that, we become part of the machine that creates the oppression. And Solomon is saying, listen, those two approaches are not going to work. But he says, listen, this is real. Look around. This is who we are. I'm not sure how to make sense of it. Third thing he says is this. He talks about loneliness, and he gives us a little story. He says, verse 7, again, I saw vanity under the sun, one person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there was no end to his toil. And his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This is also vanity and an unhappy business. He says, let me tell you about a guy who doesn't have any family. He doesn't have anybody close, but he works himself to the bone. And he works himself to the bone because that's all that he has. He has no relationships, nobody there. There's no connectedness. And then he wakes up one morning and goes, why am I doing this? I have nothing. I am so alone. This actually, next week's message is going to deal with this topic very specifically in a greater way. So I don't want to like jump into things that I'll deal with next week. But this is kind of the American deal. We are the most socially connected, while at the same time the most lonely country in the world. And the reason is because we've jumped on into the rat race and made that the king. And people wake up and they're 55 years old and go, I've worked my whole life and that's all I've done. And I don't know my wife. I don't know my kids. I don't know friends. I just got nothing. And there is a loneliness. And that loneliness just creeps out in so many different places. And see, you got the issue. Solomon is taking a look at these issues going, I just look around. I see life. I'm trying to make sense of the world, and let's be honest, these are the questions, if we're honest, these are the questions, if we could sit down like this. And there's no simple formulas that answer these questions. But what we have to realize, and here's, I mean, it's all been like depressed down on, what we have to realize as a people who are pursuing Jesus is that the reason there's no simple answers is because the answers are never found in lists. They're found in Christ alone. That's it. And if you're seeking this morning, you're probably, if you're like just checking faith out, you're trying to figure this out, you're probably like, okay, I really want a nice, neat, tidy answer to why does all this stuff happen. Solomon doesn't give us that. The Bible helps us with some of those questions, but the Bible actually says, not that God is always going to give us the answer to those questions, but that God has entered into the struggle with us. Now, the simple answer, I'm not trying to oversimplify, but I'm going to tell you the simple answer is that we were created in the image of God. That God put himself into our original parents, Adam and Eve, in such a great way that they reflected him, they were like him. They were not God, but they were created in the image of God with great value and purpose. But they chose, and we choose daily, and rather than to use that to be a reflection of God and give honor and glory to him, we choose on a daily basis to live as our own God, as the center of our own existence, and because of that, everything in this world is broken because we do not live for the glory of the one who made it, we live for our own. That's a simple, I mean, that's the theological answer. Why are all these true? Because we are our own God, and when we worship ourselves and live for only ourselves, this is the result of it. But the solution is not just, well, think happy thoughts, have a good day, here's four steps. The solution is we need to turn back to the Creator who made us and find our meaning in him. And so just to close this, I want to take you two quick passages, and I want to show you Jesus. As he deals with, first of all, in his first sermon, the first time Jesus ever preaches to a group of people, what he preaches on. And then the second, as he deals with one guy. But I just, as I get there, I just want to show you what are the ways that we deal with these issues? I mean, as we look at oppression and envy and brokenness, there's so many different things we can do. Some of us will, I mean, Solomon kind of ran to depression. Some of us, I often, this is my deal, avoidance. If I see somebody who's living in oppression, who's lonely, who's broken, I really don't want to have to deal with it. So I gloss over, I read the newspaper with this, keeping it at an arm's length distance. Some of us just kind of run to politics. If we just get the right people elected, if I could just get the right guy in office, whoever we think that is, whether that's somebody on the right or the left, they each have their solutions to these problems. If we could just get the right people, or philosophy. Let's sit in a room and ask the big questions and have deep debates on why, but it doesn't solve the oppression. A lot of times, maybe you're like this, for me, it's skepticism. I see people who are broken and hurting, and I try to figure out what it is that they, you know, why are they like that? I mean, you walk by the guy down at Busch Stadium who's sitting down there with the bucket, you know, hey, I'm homeless and down on my luck, throw a few bucks in, throw me your change. And my mind immediately begins to think, this guy's an alcoholic, he drinks, and he's just going to use my money to go buy booze. Skeptic. There's got to be something wrong with that person that they're in this situation. Or a lot of us, it's our response may be religious duty. This is big in America. I will throw a few bucks into an offering plate. I've now done my part. How does Jesus respond? Luke chapter 4, verses 16 through 21. He's preaching. It's his first sermon in his hometown. He came to Nazareth, where he'd been brought up, and he, as was his custom, he went to the synagogue, and on the Sabbath day, he stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, and what he does is he begins to read Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1 through 3. Look at the text. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and the recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down, and the eyes in all the synagogue were fixed on him. Now, you got to understand, he reads it, but in Hebrew culture, our church is a little different than a lot of churches. If you go to a lot of churches, they have a big old pulpit and a guy who stands up and, you know, he's always... You know, in the pulpit, the thing in the center of the stage that the pastor's behind preaching is the official preaching position. In a lot of churches, the official preaching position is... But that's the official... But in Hebrew culture, they would stand and read the scripture, and then they would go sit, and the official teaching position was sitting. So he's in the synagogue. He has read Isaiah 61. It says, listen, the Spirit of God is upon me. He has anointed me to bring good news to the poor, to take care of the brokenhearted, to bind up those who are hurting, and to bring the announcement of liberty to those who are oppressed. And after reading the scripture, he sits down. And everybody's looking at him. They're wondering about this kid who grew up around him, rumors about his birth, who he was, that his mom was actually a virgin when she had him. You know, he's the perfect kid, I mean, literally, in the neighborhood. And he's sitting there, and the eyes of all the synagogue were fixed on him, and he said to them, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. Jesus' answer to the issue is not, let's come up with a political solution, is not, let's solve your skepticism. Jesus' answer to the issue is this, that God himself in the person of Jesus came to enter the suffering with you, with the oppressed, with people. And by entering, he will speak into the lives of people and go so far deeper than the surface issues. He will go to the depth of the hurt, which is the human heart. And he says, today, this has been fulfilled in your hearing. The Bible, that this text goes on to say that they were amazed at what he said, perplexed, didn't know how to make sense of it. And then he looks at me and goes, I didn't expect you to get it, because nobody, no prophet gets a hearing in his hometown. And the people he grew up with tried to kill him for saying this. And here's why. Isaiah 61 was always believed by the Jews as what's called a messianic prophecy. They were looking forward to somebody coming, but they wanted a king. They wanted somebody to give power to the Jews and be a political fix. And Jesus' answer is, I am the fulfillment of what God has spoken. But the answer is not to give you power, it's to speak into the lives of the hurting. It's amazing. And so Jesus begins to live this out. And in Matthew chapter 4, he encounters a guy that kind of is a picture of this. Matthew chapter 4. I gotta find this text now. I'm sorry. Matthew chapter 8. Matthew chapter 8, verse 1. It says, when he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him. I mean, he had a throng because he had great teaching. He did cool things. And it says a leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, you need to understand that this leper who comes before him is the most ostracized, oppressed person. They had a skin disease that was massively contagious, and people feared lepers. And so they put them in these colonies where they had to live in total isolation alone the rest of their lives. Nobody had anything to do with them. Nobody would touch them. Their family would keep a distance and would shout at them across the way because they didn't want to. This was their lives, okay? And they lived in this. Now deal with, how would we deal with this? How would we respond? How would Solomon respond? If you're somebody who responds with depression, you would go home and be just like, oh, this is so sad, I can't do anything about it. Who responds with depression, you would go home and be just like, oh, this is so sad, I can't do anything about it, this is brutal. If you're somebody who kind of is avoidance, you would just never look at the people. You don't want to see it. Or maybe it's politics. Maybe the response would, let's put together a political committee to try to find a solution, but there's no solution to leprosy. You know, if it was philosophy, you would sit around having these great debates on why does that kind of stuff happen in the lives of people, but that didn't solve anything for this guy with leprosy. But look at what Jesus does. Look at this. It says he came and knelt before him saying, Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. He said, Jesus, if you will, you can make me clean. And here's the response of Jesus. This is huge. This is what he says. And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, I will be clean. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priests and offer the gift that Moses commanded for a proof to them. Now, just real simple. Don't miss the great image that Jesus reached out and touched him. This man had leprosy for a long time. He may not have had any human touch for 30 years. This is the gospel. Yes, Jesus healed him. I believe in that. I believe that Jesus, if you're here this morning, you feel oppressed, you feel broken, you feel hurting, Jesus will reach into your heart. He will heal you. It may not always be physical healing. It may not be a nice, neat, little, simple solution. But the answer of Christ is that he touches the man. He reaches into the depth of his hurt and gives him hope in the middle of it. And if you're seeking, this is the gospel. The answer to the question why is not this great philosophical answer. The answer is that Jesus will enter it with you and see you through. And if you're a follower of Jesus, what it means, this is what it means to be a follower of Jesus, that we have a king who has a kingdom. We are part of that kingdom, and the things that touch the heart of the king ought to deeply move us, which means we can't be skeptics. We can't be depressed and do nothing. We need to figure out what it means to be the hands and feet of Jesus and touch lives of people who are around us. As I'm dealing with my friend, I don't know what that means yet, but I know that somehow God is calling me to reach into his life and be the one who touches him when nobody else may. The government is not the solution to that. the gospel is. And if you're a follower of Jesus, that means that you have followed Christ, meaning that you have agreed to be somebody who represents him and is moved by the things that move him. And that's the challenge today. Solomon just threw up his hand and went, it's better off to be dead. But Jesus reached into the life of somebody who probably felt the same way. And he'll reach into your life. And he will use you to reach in the lives of others. That's the gospel. That's the message, okay? I'm going to pray. Band's going to come out and we're going to worship. And if you need the touch of Jesus, I just want to tell you that it's real and he's there. He will move in your life. Listen, it's not my life is a wreck. I pray everything's perfect. It's my life is a wreck. I pray I meet Jesus and now he walks with me through it. Trust him. And if you're here and you're a follower of Jesus, the challenge and the message is, how do I become his hands and feet this week? Who is it that I need to reach into and quit being a skeptic? Teachers, what? That kid that drives you crazy may be that way because his life at home is an absolute wreck. And nobody's touched that kid in a way that's good for 10 years. You know, that's the message. That's the gospel. I hope it's challenging to you this morning. I'm going to pray. We're going to take up an offering. If you're a guest, we do not ask or want you to give. This service is our gift to you. But we take up an offering because in our service, the taking of an offering is an act of worship that says, God has done so much for me, and now I'm giving back to God. We're going to sing and celebrate Jesus because he is the one who touches and moves into our lives. And he is also the one who calls us to be an extension of his kingdom in these issues. So we're going to, after I pray, stand, celebrate, sing about Jesus, and worship him this morning. If you have questions, I'll be hanging around. I'd love to talk with you more about the struggle, oppression, resources, or about Jesus if you have questions. I'm going to pray. Jesus, we love you, we praise you, worship, and celebrate you. And I just pray this morning as we consider the messed up world around us, we will see that you entered into this world as a human being in the person of Jesus and entered our struggle with us. Thank you for doing that and not leaving us alone. And thank you that in Christianity, we do not have a simple solution, but we do have a person who walks through. We love you, Lord. We praise you. In your name I pray. Amen.